This material is subject to copyright. No unauthorized recording, editing, copying, or distribution is permitted without the consent of the Economic Research Council. All rights reserved. For more information, visit www.ercouncil.org. Audio lectures by the Economic Research Council.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for coming to this special meeting of the ERC. I don't think we've ever had such a large attendance before. Thank you for coming to this Clash of the Titans. I think it's agreed that generally the world is facing a very serious economic situation indeed. We've been living through a post-bubble situation in many countries. Several countries have enjoyed housing booms, which ended with housing slumps. We've had banking crises. We've had debt in the housing markets moving to the banks, moving from the banks to governments, and moving from governments back to the banks. At the same time, we have a very serious crisis in the Eurozone. Only 12 years after the first creation of the euro, which has all these same elements intertwined in it. So it's not surprising that many people think we have an unprecedented situation. And yet there are very many different views as to what is the correct response to the situation. We have some who advocate fiscal expansion, some who advocate fiscal retrenchment. We have differing views over the role of monetary policy. So the ERC decided that we would invite three leading economists from the three leading economics faculties in this country to discuss the situation. Of course, it's well known that if you get five different economists in a room, you'll probably get 10 different opinions, three of them all attributed to Maynard Keynes, but nonetheless, we decided that we would proceed and invite one distinguished professor from Oxford University, one distinguished professor from Cambridge University, and one distinguished professor from the London School of Economics. Each speaker is going to speak firstly for 10 minutes, drawing on their own particular expertise, how they see the world economy, 5 minutes on three things they would do if they were in power in 2012, and 5 minutes giving specific economic forecasts. This is not meant to be an economic equivalent of the boat race or a sporting event. Everyone knows that economic forecasts should be taken with a pinch of salt. As a Russian economist once said to me, economic forecasting is like looking for a black cat in a room with the lights out and the cat isn't there. Or as the Japanese put it, 6 inches ahead and all is darkness. I once heard a fellow of the Royal Statistical Society, I'm not sure it wasn't in this building, once say about forecasting. He said, "The past has its own uncertainty, although on the whole, it's not as great as that of the future." And I think that's absolutely right. We can't actually decipher what has happened in the past, let alone in the future. But forecasting is a useful discipline for people who make policy prescriptions. So our three speakers tonight are John Muhlbauer, Fellow of Nuffield College, Professor of Economics at Oxford, whose speciality has very much been the housing market, both in the United States and here as well. Then we will have Hashim Peshauran, who is a Fellow of Trinity College, Cambridge, and Professor of Economics at Cambridge. He must be the only person, I would guess, ever to be a professor at Cambridge University, having worked in the Central Bank of Iran and indeed having been an undersecretary at the Ministry of Education in Iran. He's also been a professor of economics at UCLA. And then we have Danny Kwa, professor of economics at the LSE, who is a member of the World Economic Forum and who has been a visiting professor at a number of distinguished universities in Asia. So I'm going to start by inviting Professor John Muhlbauer if he would give his presentation. You're very welcome.
Thank you very much for that great introduction. Very helpful for forecasters to know these things. Current research, well, a lot of my research has been about financial real economy linkages. So I'm also going to talk briefly about Eurobonds because that's an important form of the financial real economy linkage. But before I do so, you'll be surprised to find that my presentation is rather less pessimistic than you might have expected. So let me just start on a pessimistic note. I think the risks of mass species extinction, given the human coordination failures on climate change, I think that's the real problem that we face. And I'm terribly pessimistic about the next century. And I recommend everyone to have a look at this wonderful paper by David Hendry at Oxford on climate change. So let me turn to my current research. The first bit of this is actually based on a keynote I gave last week at the ECB in a conference on financial flows and the financial crisis. So what we're about is understanding interactions between the financial sector and the real economy. In addition, we want to explain the secular decline in the US saving rate, understand triggers for financial instability, and also, we want to be able to interpret the data better on the growth of credit, money, and asset prices. I mean, these things are crucial for central banks, and for too long, central banks have ignored these really important aspects of the real world. And then finally, as an econometrician, how do we handle major evolutionary structural change? That's a really, really big problem for econometrics. When the world is changing, how do we adapt our models to reflect the changing world? Well, to give an example of how the world has changed, U.S. credit markets have gone through a revolution in the last 30, 40 years. First of all, the spread in credit card ownership and installment credit, the creation of the government-sponsored enterprises, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, big changes in technology, IT costs have fallen enormously, so payment and credit screening systems have been transformed. And then we had the subprime revolution in the 2000s, started a little bit before the 2000s, but primarily in the 2000s. And we had changes in regulation. So interest rate ceilings were lifted in the early 80s. Banks, and particularly investment banks, were deregulated, which had a big impact on their behavior. And then all these innovations, the rise of private label securitization backed by credit default obligations and swaps. And, of course, the politicians got involved as well in putting pressure on the official agencies and the private sector to extend credit to the poor. So we had the subprime boom and bust, which conventional housing models missed. A key feature of our work is what we call the credit-augmented permanent income hypothesis for consumption. So the idea is that the old-fashioned life cycle permanent income model for consumption doesn't really hold anymore because of these vast changes in the credit market. So we need to adapt the old story to take account of shifting access to consumer and mortgage debt. So in our model, we don't impose efficient market assumptions. We don't assume rational expectations. Instead, we use a survey that uses real people and asks them questions about their view of the future. In our model, asset price is not just a reflexive indicator of what happens, but play a key role. And consumers are not necessarily rational, intertemporal optimizers who can smooth away shocks. So this is how we think about the household financial accelerator as it applied in the U.S. mortgage and housing crisis. So at the top, we had the beginning of the crisis. And then on the left-hand side, a channel that works on the far left through construction, a collapse in construction, which accounted for something like a 4% fall in gross domestic product in the US. Then the second channel is through households, through consumption, an impact on housing collateral, which reduced the amount that people spent. All that feeds into slower GDP growth. And right, on the right-hand side, you've got the feed-throughs through the financial system. Once loans went bad, the asset position of the financial sector shrank. Credit standards were then tightened. spreads rose, that feeds into slower GDP growth. And then, of course, you've got these feedbacks. Tighter credit feeds back onto the housing market, which feeds back onto construction, onto GDP. And then finally, lower GDP growth, of course, reinforces the crisis. So at this stage, you really have to have policy intervention. You have to have the central bank and the fiscal authorities coming to the rescue of the private sector where these destabilizing feedbacks are going on. Now, in fact, the US or the global financial crisis had a kind of pre-run in the UK, as some of you may remember. In the 1980s, we had a great big credit and house price boom, which ended very badly. In fact, in a paper in 1990, which Mervyn King was kind enough to discuss at the time, we applied an early version of these ideas. But our current modeling is a lot more sophisticated. We estimate a system of equations that captures consumer spending, mortgage refinancing, equity withdrawal. Tim Congdon will love that. Mortgage debt and house prices. And then we extract a measure of how mortgage credit has expanded as part of this system. So some of the key insights are these. One really important one is that the impact of housing wealth and consumption is not constant. It was pretty much zero in the 1970s, but at the peak in 2007, a $100 rise in housing wealth led to roughly a $3.6 increase in spending. Another finding is that money really matters. Liquid assets are much more spendable than illiquid assets, about six times more spendable. The model also reveals the vulnerability of households to higher debt, because higher debt is like negative liquid assets. The debt has a power, if you like, about six times, but negative, of that of the stock market in terms of the impact on spending. So the model explains the shifting correlation of credit with consumption. For example, increased access to credit increases both consumption and debt, but high debt for a given degree of access to debt is bad for consumption. So we have to have good models to interpret the data and warn of financial instability. Let me just show you, tell you a story which our model reveals about what happened in the US. So the red line is the ratio of consumption to income. And that rose by about 15% between the early 70s and 2006, 2007. That's the red line. Now, we can explain in our model what the key drivers of that were. And this is the first of two slides. The second slide fills in the rest of the story. So the blue line is the contribution of improved access to credit of the non-secured kind. So in other words, increased access to personal loans, to credit cards, that sort of thing, is the blue line. So that measures the impact on the consumption-to-income ratio of that change in the financial market architecture. The purple line, which has this huge peak that you can see in 2006, it rises enormously from a trough in about 92 to a peak in about 2007. That's the purple line. That is the impact of housing wealth as amplified by the changing marginal propensity to spend. So you can see that much of the rise in the consumption to income ratio is driven by what happened in the housing market. So both the combination of house price rises and increased spendability of housing had that effect. Now, when you borrow more, you get more into debt. And debt has a negative aspect. As I said, you've got to pay back debt. And the dotted purple line that has a downward slope that troughs in 2006, that is net liquid assets, the effect of net liquid assets minus debt. So that line tells you that in about 2002, the U.S. household sector had more debt in aggregate than it had as liquid assets, saving deposits largely. So that's the payback aspect of this, and that has a very depressing effect and offsets the upward momentum that comes from the two credit indicators. So the rest of the story is, well, there's a stock market effect, there's an interest rate effect, and there's income expectations. The purple dotted line is the stock market. So that's the purple dotted line that's just below the red line. So you can see stock market booms and busts, the 2001 bust and when the dot-com bubble burst had quite a noticeable effect, as the purple dotted line reveals, on the consumption to income ratio. The blue line in the middle, that is the effect of income growth expectations. So as consumers got more optimistic about their future income, that's the permanent income effect, if you like, that had an effect on certainly a cyclical effect, but it doesn't explain any of the long-run trend. So you can't explain the long-run trend in the U.S. consumption to income ratio and hence in the saving ratio in terms of income expectations. So conclusions, I've already mentioned them, basically. Debt-fueled consumption is a problem. It's hard to build up liquid assets and pay back debt, whereas asset prices can fall suddenly. Credit can suddenly dry up. So the unsustainable aspect of the credit architecture in the U.S. was a major problem, and it required major policy interventions to sort that out. So let me move then to the more current aspect of the financial crisis that we face in Europe, which is another aspect of the interaction between finance and the real world. Now, Hashim Pesrin is going to talk quite a lot more about this, but since I've been blogging quite a lot on this issue and pursuing a campaign to get people to kind of wake up and respond better, I thought I would talk about this. Obviously, there's a feedback loop involved here as well. Sovereign debt concerns raise questions about the solvency of governments and the banking sector. The shrinking credit supply then feeds back to the real economy, undermining solvency further. So that's the feedback loop that can lead to a real crisis. The sovereign spreads that we've seen in the last few months reflect not just risk about individual countries, but market panic about this feedback loop and indeed whether the Eurozone would break apart. So my proposal is conditional Eurobonds, in which each country pays a risk spread into a common fund, which helps to ensure the guarantor governments, the Germans, the French, the Dutch, and so on, who would collectively underwrite Eurobonds. There's even a suggestion the gold and forex reserves of each country could be used as collateral for such borrowing. Now, the risk spreads formula should be linked, in my view, to competitiveness and as well as debt to GDP. So that rewards countries for bringing down debt and rewards them for making structural reforms, but punishes them if they don't. So, you know, if you don't improve your competitiveness and if your debt to GDP ratio rises further, the cost of borrowing, the internal cost of borrowing, rises. So this is very different from the transfer union that's feared by Germany. When the Germans oppose euro bonds, they're afraid that they're being asked to subsidize the southern periphery. And this is definitely not what's involved here. So let me move to my UK policy recommendations. Now, the UK has, as we all know, a very serious problem. If you add up UK household, government, and banking sector debt as a fraction of GDP, I think we hold the world record now that Iceland is off the chart. So how do we walk this tightrope, combining the fiscal austerity that we evidently need, given this debt that we owe, with growth promotion? Well, I'm going to propose several possibilities. One very clear point comes out of looking at housing. The UK is underhoused, so it's very different from Ireland, Spain, and the US, where there's this huge overhang from the excessive construction that went on during the boom. We didn't have that. So that suggests that reducing the supply constraints that constrain housing, improving the incentives for investment in private rented sector, and changing the planning system, and indeed dealing with the implicit taxpayer subsidy of hundredfold or more planning gains for owners of land giving plan permission, if one could tackle those problems, then I think we could have a substantial increase in construction, which with benefits for everyone, for employment, for welfare, and so on. My second UK policy recommendation is to invest in infrastructure and human capital. And of course, now it's too late. You know, we've had this wasteful NHS restructuring embarked on. Instead of that, my view was that we should have had public sector pay cuts and pension reform, and need a mansion tax to raise the revenue to pay for investment in infrastructure and human capital. And very closely connected with human capital, of course, is the universities. Higher education is one of the UK's great potential export industries and is now being hampered by really quite clumsy new immigration restrictions. And finally, I think that the UK would do itself and the world a great favour by radically reforming the tax havens over which it itself has jurisdiction in order to aid global efforts to rein in tax avoidance and the power of the oligarchs. Well, I'm not saying that current policies are all wrong. I think many policies are good. The credit easing the government is currently embarked on, substituting for what the Bank of England should have been doing, but hasn't, I think is on the right lines. Let me turn to the forecasts. Well, when you forecast, you have to think about scenarios. Okay, and the critical global risks seem to me to be these three. There's German brinkmanship, potentially leading the Eurozone to disintegrate and leading to a banking and credit crisis in Europe. That's one risk. A second one is stagnation in the US. Certainly we have political policy paralysis on the fiscal side and potentially a continued drag from property markets. The third risk seems to me China. Now, China currently has a ratio of consumption to GDP, which is half that of the US and the UK. It's about 35%. I suspect this could be a world record for a major economy. What's going on? Well, partly what's going on is very high rates of investment and, of course, exports. Investment, much of which is in speculative property development. Now, that's a model for corruption and getting rich quick, which has, I think, long-run serious negatives. Local government revenue, instead of being based on VAT or income tax, is largely based on land sales for property development. Now, you know, these land sales depend on high property prices and on high turnover and a continued boom in that market. So what's going to happen to local government revenue if that came to a halt? And then you've got a shadow banking system that's very hard to control, much bigger than it used to be. Now, in an economy where investment is such a high fraction of GDP, imagine what happens if investment falls. That feeds back quite strongly on GDP and then back on investment. So potentially, there could be some big negative feedback loops in China. And you know, there's a lot of uncertainty there, I think. So what assumptions do I make? Well, I believe the Eurozone's problems are soluble. I think with conditional Eurobonds, with internal devaluations of the kind that we've seen in Ireland. In Ireland, unit labor costs have fallen by 17% in the last 3 years. And structural reforms, I think these problems are soluble. But of course, the current, how quickly will they be solved? I think it could take at least several more months. And therefore, I think that UK GDP in the current quarter and the first quarter of 2012 will have been affected by the Eurozone crisis. And that's why I expect actually negative GDP growth in the current quarter and the next quarter. Now, let me turn to the US. What assumptions on the US? Actually, back in December 2009, for a paper that was delivered at the American Economic Association conference in January 2010, my colleagues at the Fed and I made some predictions, did some simulations for our house price model for the US. We correctly foresaw that it would be a second leg of house price falls. You can find this on the web. We suggested that the bottom in average US nominal house prices was likely to happen in 2012. Now, if we're right about that, then much of the negative drag on the US economy would be removed. And if at the same time the euro crisis has been resolved, then that negative influence on the US will also disappear. So I think we could actually see quite good performance in the US economy, particularly, you know, from the second quarter onwards. This, by the way, is what our simulation, that's taken from that paper that's on the web for the January 2010 conference. These are our different scenarios. The baseline is the red one. You can see that it shows a bit of a drop, and it bottoms in about 2012. And we haven't had the need to make major changes in those forecasts in the intervening time. So these are my forecasts. As you can see, GDP negative in 2011 Q4, negative in 2012 Q1, and then picking up a bit as the beneficial influence of a US recovery starts feeding in. Inflation is going to come down, partly because of base effects. Unemployment will carry on rising for a bit. It lags behind GDP. Interest rates will stay the same. French bond yields, quite a lot lower than the peak they reached in 2011, because I think the euro crisis will be solved. Well, what about the China assumption? The UK forecast, I think, is less sensitive than the German forecast would be to the China assumption. A Chinese slowdown would reduce oil and commodity prices, which for us would be like a great big tax cut, which is great. Exporters to China, on the other hand, the Germans in particular, would lose. Basically, that's what I've just said. The rest of that spells out what I said. Inflation will drop. Unemployment lags behind GDP, will rise for a bit more. And French bond yields will peak at rates much lower than in 2011. I think that's pretty much the end. Thanks.